How you doing, everyone? I'm Russ Salzberg, and I want you all to listen up and get a load of this. My very special guest on this show, Mr. Chris Carino, the outstanding radio voice of the Brooklyn Nets, who not only does a terrific job, but he does so despite dealing with a debilitating disease, muscular dystrophy. So like I said, listen up, because you're really going to want to get a load of this. All right, like I said, my guest today, Mr. Chris Carino, in his 18th year, I believe it is, as the radio voice of the Nets. Chris, welcome. Thanks for being on.
Russ, this is a great thing for me to do this. I'm not to make you feel older than you may feel, but you are
making me feel older, but that's okay.
I grew up, you know, watching you on Channel 9 and Channel 5 and listening to you with the Schmoozer in the afternoons on the Fan when I was a younger broadcaster, dreaming about doing this stuff for a living, and so it's an honor to have to be on with you.
Well, believe me, buddy, it's an honor to have you on. Now, I am correct. This is your 18th year. Am I right?
As the full-time play-by-play guy.
That's
yeah.
what I mean. As the full-time play-by-play yeah. guy. But I mean, you. I mean, you go back with them to the 90s, am I correct?
I do. We were trying to figure out this the other day because I was at Media Day, and I said, you know what? This was my 27th Nets Media Day going back to my first year out of college in 1992. I had gotten a part-time job with the Nets as a studio producer, and I would cover Media Day to get some sound, and it was at Princeton. And Chuck Daly was beginning his first year as the head coach, coming right off the Dream Team
right.
from Barcelona in 92.
I'll digress a second. You mentioned Chuck Daly. I had the pleasure of getting to know Chuck very well. We actually became pretty darn good friends. I was friends with him and his assistant, Brendan Sir. But mm-hmm. I have to tell you, when we talk about great managers and coaches –
yeah.
Guys who, you know, obviously, you know, the Torres and the Parcells and those names always prop up. I got to tell you, Chuck Daly is one of the finest coaches I have ever come across in any sport, any place.
Yeah.
Not just the way he handled business on the court, but the way he handled business off the court. He was relaxed about it. It was a gem to watch.
Yeah, what I thought was great about Chuck Daly is he related to every player, whether it be a star player, the end of the bench guy. He was able to relate to those guys. It was an incredible decision to make him that Dream Team coach. I mean, he was one of the few guys I really think that, for a lot of the reasons you just said, was able to get the most out of that group. And everybody could say, well, there was just so much unbelievable talent. Yeah, but if you saw that Dream Team documentary where they all came together and it really didn't click right away and a college all-star team came in and beat them in a scrimmage that nobody knew about and how Chuck Daly wanted that to happen and it galvanized this team. The thing that I always look with Chuck Daly is I look at how all other coaches and people always quote Chuck Daly.
You're right.
You know, you get guys today. I do it a lot of times. I use the phrase all the time in games when teams are down big and they come back but they don't win the game. I always quote Chuck Daly saying, you know, Chuck Daly used to say, it's easy to come back, it's hard to win. And so many coaches, mm-hmm. and when I work with Tim Capstraw on the radio, we're always mentioning things that Chuck Daly said. And, you know, that's when you know you've got the respect. You know, long after he's gone, people are still talking about him.
I'll tell you, the one thing, and then we'll move on, because I want to talk about the present-day Nets and so much about you and your story. But yeah. the one, I remember this on back-to-back days. In back in the days of the New Jersey Nets, remember they used to practice at that trucking company?
Yes.
Right? AD, what I forget whatever it was. The
yeah.
trucking company, just not far from Secaucus. But anyway, I remember coming in one day, and they're practicing, and I see Derek Coleman sitting to the side. You know, not practicing. And I go over to Chuck. He says, what's with Derek? And he gives me, it was the way he handled things. Just matter of fact, he looked at me, goes, he claims he's got a toothache. I go, okay. He says, he goes, watch tomorrow, because he has a toothache today. Watch, you come to practice tomorrow, Kenny Anderson will have something bothering him. I walk into practice the next day. Kenny Anderson is sitting in the exact same spot, and Chuck looks at me and says, I told you, today it's an earache.
He knew. He had a feel for players.
He just had a tremendous feel for players. But that was then, and this is now. And now we have the Brooklyn Nets, and Kenny Atkinson is going into his third season as the man in charge on the court. And I have to tell you, I don't know Kenny well. Met him once or twice, but Kenny strikes quite frankly, listen, you look at the record, and you know, he was 20-62 in his first year and 28-54 in his second year. But you know, Sean Marks picked the right guy for the job. I think this Kenny Atkinson is made of the right stuff. He came into a difficult situation, and I think he knows how to deal with it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, the problem when you're with a rebuilding team, you know, the wins and losses count on your record. They don't go away. And a lot of people don't want to hear, well, early on in my career, you know, they're going to quote your record, and it's going to keep adding up. So, you know, these coaches don't like to lose all these games, even though they know they're developing talent. But you're right. I mean, Kenny's in the right place at the right time. He's a New York guy. He was a hard-nosed player in high school out in Long Island and at Richmond. And, you know, he's always been sort of the overachiever. He went over and played in Europe. He's had a lot of stops in his coaching life. He's been an assistant. And he got that reputation of being a guy that develops young players. And that's what he's doing. That's what, you know, the Nets were so deep in a hole, Russ. After all those trades shook out, and when Sean Marks took over, I mean, they had no draft picks. They were in the tax in terms of over the salary cap, and they didn't have any keepers on the roster. And you look, in 3 years, there's one guy that's still left that they inherited, and that's Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who was a good draft pick by the old regime because he was, you know, maybe a little better than where he was drafted. But he's a guy that could have been out of the league if I don't think Kenny Atkinson came in and helped him discover the kind of player that he should be. It's just a really good example of that. So when you're so deep in a hole that way in terms of your rebuild with no assets, no cap space, no draft picks, well, you know, what do you got to do? You got to find G League guys, second round guys, undrafted guys, and see if you can build them into NBA rotation players. And I think that's what they've been able to do. They take, you know, late second round picks like Spencer Dinwiddie, who is a cast off,
right?
And in the G League, and bring him in. And what, he was in one of, he was a candidate for most improved player last year. You know, you've got to find those type of guys, and now you can start. Now you've got your own draft pick coming up next year. You've got salary cap space next year. Now they kind of get on the clock.
So that brings me to this. Exactly, you used the phrase I was going to use. So now they're on the clock. Next year, that becomes the big year. So what do you look for if you're Kenny Atkinson and the Nets in this coming season, which starts next Wednesday night, next Wednesday night in Detroit against the Pistons?
I mean, just to first just finish off with Kenny is, I think that, you know, I did a game today, the China game for NBA TV, and I'm watching the Sixers play Dallas. And the Sixers have Brett Brown as the head coach. And Kenny reminds me a lot of Brett Brown, when Brett Brown took over the Sixers. Here's a guy now getting a chance to be a head coach that hadn't been a head coach, very well-respected assistant, and in a situation where you know they're going to be bad for a few years. But what can he do? And what he's done is he always stayed positive. You know, really upbeat guy, good energy, didn't let all the losing get to him, and that's kind of Kenny. And now he's in that situation where, all right, he's been a developing guy. There was losing that was expected, so he was upbeat. So now when they're expected to maybe win a few games, what's his attitude going to be? Is he going to stay energetic, excited? If they start losing, if they go through a stretch where they have a hard time, is he going to be able to keep that level and keep developing young players? How do you balance, well, I want to get these young guys better. Sean Marks wants me to develop these young players. But like we said in the beginning, these losses count on my record. I want to go out and win some games. I think the Nets are in that in-between right now. The rebuild is not totally complete. Kenny still has to develop young players. They still got to find some young players. But I think they're still at a point where you're not going to judge them, or at least I don't think you should judge them, on how many games they win. I think what you're going to have to judge them on, in my opinion, is are the young players that improved last year, are they going to make a jump and get incrementally better this year? Can they make this an organization that's attractive to good players that want to come play here as free agents so that they can use that cap space? That's going to be the key to me. And I know fans, you know, they get a little impatient. They say, well, it's, you know, we saw a little winning last year. We saw they lost a lot of close games, so they won 28 games. They really should have won 35. I know the East isn't very good. I'm telling you, they added a couple of pieces here. They should be a playoff team. Well, I think you gotta temper that enthusiasm right now. Don't worry about winning 40 games, getting to the playoffs. I think they've got one more year in them where we say, hey, can we keep improving the roster? Can we make this an attractive situation going forward? And I think Kenny is the right guy to do that. I think Sean Marks is the right guy to do that. I just don't want people to get too carried away. It would be great if they can win 40 games, get to the playoffs. That would be great for these young players. It would be great for the organization. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't mean that this group has failed.
Well,
they're still building right now.
Yeah, I listen, you know it. You know, being a Yonkers guy, rebuilding in this city, in any sport, is a very, very difficult task because they don't let you do it. When I say they, and not just the fans, the media as well, they don't let you do it.
Yeah.
They want immediate results. I mean,
you know how it is, though, Russell. But a lot of times, I don't know if there's been a team that I can remember that was in such a bad hole. Because another thing that New York does is sometimes they make you swing for the fences, right? We love sluggers.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what the Nets did when they brought in Pierce and Garnett.
Yep.
And you said, hey, they're taking a swing for the seats right now. If they miss, it's going to be a Dave Kingman swing and a miss, fall down in the dirt.
Yep, no, that's exactly what it was.
They're going to be so, you know, so far in a hole, and that's what happened. So it's a big dig to get out of it. And luckily, you know, the Nets fly a little under the radar.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so they people can be a little more patient, you know, but you do have a core group that's really into them, and they're the ones that aren't going to be as patient. But I do think if they do this the right way, and I think ownership has given Sean Marks the mandate, Kenny Atkinson the mandate, do this the right way, unlike we did it 3 years ago, being impatient, do this the right way now, and boy, if they can develop into a model organization in this area, and then they'll grow their fan base.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Brett Brown, because I was thinking the same thing, and you know, no joke intended here, but you know that saying that people say, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
I mean, really, losing, not just on coaches, on young players as well. You know, a lot of these guys, you know, they come from winning programs, so they're not used to getting, for lack of a term, knocked on their ass day in and day out, or night in and night out. And, you know, the coach goes through with them. But if they can, and not every coach has the stomach to be in a rebuilding situation.
No.
I'm
happy that the Sixers, when they finally got the horses, didn't say, all right, Brett, thanks for your service. We're going to go with a guy who is a proven winner. No, they recognized what Brett Brown had been. He'd been around the organization. They loved the guy that he is, and now they're giving him a chance to coach this team when they've got the horses.
Yeah, reap the benefits.
But now, you know, he's got to show that he can do it. He can coach at that level. You know, Kenny Atkinson is going to find out the same thing. You know, I can develop guys, but, you know, these guys have been here. Kenny was around Budenholzer in Atlanta, and he was around D'Antoni in Houston. He comes from winning culture. Same thing, you know, Brett Brown was around the Spurs for for years and years. They've been around a winning culture, so they're losing now, but they know what it takes to win. That's the reason why they have those jobs, you know.
Yeah, without question. Before I get on to you, the man, and what you're dealing with, what do you think, you know, how, you know, for example, LeBron in L.A., where's the balance of power in the NBA, you know, in your thinking right now, Chris?
Well, I mean, the balance is certainly out west. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And the fact that LeBron is no longer in Cleveland has slanted it even more. I mean, the Lakers, boy, they could be pretty good, but they're kind of in between there. They bring in, you know, they bring in LeBron, and then they're bringing in Rondo and Lance Stevenson, these kind of guys. And but then they're trying to develop young players. Talk about trying to sort of rebuild on the fly. They're doing that in L.A. And I don't even know if, you know, there's a lot of teams that you can say should be playoff teams out there, and only eight are going to get in. The East has been a little different with LeBron out of the East. You know, Boston's going to be better, obviously, because they were really good last year, and now they're getting Gordon Hayward back off the injury, and Kyrie's coming back. You know, Toronto adds Kawhi Leonard, which could make them really good. But then you got a lot of questions and a lot of interesting situations out there. So the East is sort of up for grabs. It's still, the balance is still out there in the West. It's just interesting. I think LeBron finally made a decision to what him and his family wanted to do, where they wanted to live.
Yeah.
You know, I don't begrudge him or that or anybody in that situation. I mean, LeBron's made a lot of decisions over the years to win. You know, he tried to take his hometown team, Cleveland, and couldn't get there, so he went and joined Wade and Bosch in Miami, and that was all about winning a championship, and he got that off his back, and then he returned home, and he brought a championship back to Cleveland, which, I think was something he was very proud to do. And now he's making a decision for him.
He's playing, you know, by the rules. I mean, you know, the rules allow him to do that.
He wants to go play in Los Angeles. He lives out there, and
he's allowed.
Loves it out there. Great. Yeah. You know, it's you know, you're joining the ranks of the greats, and you know, how are you? I don't think LeBron needs to worry about his legacy anymore. You know, I think he's secured his legacy. I mean, he's that conversation with Jordan as far as the greatest of all time. I don't think anything that happens from here on in is going to change anything.
If you get into that conversation, you're doing pretty good. With me, folks, is Mr. Chris Carino. And listen, not only, as I said, does he do the Nets, now in his 18th year, he also does NFL football for its Compass Radio. In fact, yesterday you were in Kansas City doing a Chiefs Jaguars game.
Yeah.
I'd say Mr. Mahomes, he's the real deal. I mean, right now, he and the Chiefs are the real deals.
He is, and I think he didn't have the greatest of games yesterday. He didn't have a game like he had had in the first 4 weeks, but he was going up against a great defense, and he made it look easy. I mean, not Showtime going crazy throwing 80-yard bombs, but boy, he was able to, he puts balls in windows, tight windows, and he throws 20, 30-yard strikes effortlessly. Got a good head on his shoulders for a young kid. Yeah, a couple of interceptions yesterday. You knew they were coming. But the fact that he was able to, they go through a game like that and they win, you know, pretty easy. It's a really creative offense there. You know, Andy Reid's done a terrific job. Talk about underrated coaches in sports. I know he hasn't won the big one as much as, you know, when people would want, but, that's a really creative system, and they've got the right guy, and it's the modern-day NFL quarterback. You can move, athletic, and he throws a fastball like anybody in these Major League Baseball playoffs wishes they could.
Well, remember, his daddy was a Major League pitcher for 11 seasons, so he knows a little bit about throwing fastballs.
Yeah, and their defense, which had sort of been maligned, you know, came up with a defensive touchdown, bent but didn't break. They're still the best third down team in the NFL, so they could be a – right now, I mean, I don't know if there's a team – that looks better than the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yeah, I after five games, I would have to agree. Chris, before we get on to you, I'm just going to take care of a little business here. So sports fans, listen up. Football season is here, and it is time to get in on the action with MyBookie.net. That's right. MyBookie.net is the industry-leading sports action website offering real Vegas odds on football, baseball, and all your favorite sporting events. You can take a side, the total, or you can even bet the over-under on how many fantasy points a player is going to score. MyBookie.net lets you play online and win big. Use promo code LOAD100 when you register for your account and get a 100% signing bonus. That's right, 100%. Did the game already kick off? Forget about it. No reason to worry. MyBookie.net has in-game live action on every major league event, even esports. There is no better time to join MyBookie.net than today. Right now, go to MyBookie.net to open an account and start winning. Use promo code LOAD100 when you register for your account and get a 100% sign-up bonus. That's 100%, folks. Get in on the action. Visit MyBookie.net's website today and use promo code LOAD100 to get a 100% sign-up bonus. MyBookie.net, promo code LOAD100 for a 100% bonus. Got it? No deposit necessary. Terms and conditions apply for entertainment purposes. Void where prohibited. You know, Chris, I'm talking with you, and it's almost chilling to me, like your voice comes through crystal clear. You are a bundle of energy. All of your broadcasts are the exact same way. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but Chris Carino, folks, does this heavy load of work, all the games, football, basketball, and he does this despite suffering from muscular dystrophy, to be more precise. And if I don't pronounce it correctly, Chris, you can correct me. Fascioscapulohumeral dystrophy. Is that,
yes,
is that
that's
it?
Why we say FSHD. A little easier.
FSHD. And because of this, Chris has his own foundation, Chris Carino Foundation.org. Well, first of all, Chris, let me ask you this. How are you doing? Because you've been, you were diagnosed how many years ago?
Almost about 25 years ago.
About 25 years ago.
So I've gotten to that point now where obviously it's a genetic condition you're born with. And in hindsight, when doctors diagnosed me, they looked back at, I had a neurologist wanted to see my pictures of me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, looked at pictures of me when I was 10, 11 years old and just saw the way my smile was. And he said, I could see it then.
Really?
The weakness in your facial muscles. But until it really started to affect me to a point where I was falling, if I was trying to play a sport and suddenly I'd be running to first base and I'd fall, you know, playing baseball or softball, what I was playing, that was in my college years, and it started to be, well, all right, well, there's something going on here. And then you go to a doctor and he tells you, thinks you have muscular dystrophy. And, you know, now I've gotten to the point where I've lived longer with it, or at least since my diagnosis, than before, which is...
You know, How old are you now, Chris?
I'm 48.
So you've lived, and you've died, so you live longer with it.
Yeah, now I've got it.
Now, wow.
Yeah. Or at least knowing it. I've always had it, but at least knowing it, you know, since the diagnosis has been, you know, more than before. And, you know, as far as how I'm doing, I mean, it's a progressive disease, and you're working with the fact that you're getting older, so anybody would be sort of, you know, physically, when you get past 40, you're starting to, you know, you start to go the other way a little bit physically. It's why athletes retire in their late 30s.
Sure.
And then you're dealing with the fact that it's a progressive muscle wasting disease, so you've got a sort of a double whammy, and it can accelerate at my age, and it's, you know, you lose a little bit here and there every year, and then what happens is, though, you get to a point where sometimes you lose just that little tipping point, and now suddenly it makes things a lot harder. So we can get into a lot of different areas that's all about. I try and correct people when they say I suffer from muscular dystrophy. I just say I'm challenged by it. You know, no way do I consider myself suffering. You know, mm-hmm. Things are hard, and it's a challenge. It's a lot harder than than people even realize, or that I want to sometimes admit. But you know, I have a terrific career, a lot of great friends, and a great family, and you know, I don't see it as suffering at all.
Well, you know what? You use the term challenge, and really, challenge is the correct terminology, if you will, because you know, as you know, and you know, I'm sure some of the listeners know. You know, I've been involved with the MDA for 30 years. I used to do the Jerry Lewis Telethon. We still do our annual Muscle Team Gala each year, raising a lot of money. And the thing about it is, you say challenge is correct, but it's not just a challenge for the person facing the challenge. It's also a challenge for the families. And that, to me... Listen, you told me something that, you know, here, knock wood, I'm knocking my head. I'll knock the microphone, too. I mean, you were diagnosed something like 25 years ago. How many years you married?
I'm married. We're married 16 years.
16 years.
A couple days ago, yeah.
So Laura, your lovely wife, was well aware of what she was getting into, you know, knowing that this was the case. And you also have Chris Jr. And, you know, it's got to be, it's a challenge for them as well, no?
No, absolutely. And I think that happens is you see, you get into it and yeah, you know where it's going to go, but you really don't. And, but if you love that person enough, then you know, for better or for worse, sickness and in health, you know, you want to be there. You know, my wife will always say to me, well, I know that you know, sometimes I get a little frustrated or something's going on and she's there to help me and I feel bad. And it's just like, well, I know if things were reversed, you'd be there to help me. And I'd say, you know, I know, of course. And if one of us had to go through something, I'd want it to be me and not you.
Right.
But you have that love and respect for each other. And, you know, sometimes I'll lament when I was younger about not being able to do certain things with my son. But you know, my wife would remind me all the time, you know, you were able to give him and show him by what you do as an example in your life. Then, you know, that's invaluable too. He's growing up with that other fathers can't give him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always something that, you know, you find that silver lining. And, you know, I will say this, Russ, and just to go back and touch on the fact you've been with the MDA and doing your work in the telethon for 30 years. I mean, I've watched you on the telethon for all those years, and I so respect what you've done for all those children with muscular dystrophy, and you continue to do. And, you know, it's funny, I grew up watching that telethon. It was always a highlight of my summer.
We all did.
Yeah, and I remember I even have an aunt out in Long Island who worked the phones. And would always look forward to it every year and helping. And then she, a couple of years ago, she, you know, took a lot, went around and asked for donations from my foundation. And what's incredible is when I'm sitting in a doctor's office when I'm 23 years old and not thinking anything about muscular dystrophy, and a doctor's looking at my, you know, the atrophy in my right arm, and he says, you have some kind of a muscular dystrophy. And immediately my thought is that telethon. You know, it's Jerry Lewis. It's the kids in wheelchairs. And that's what I said to the doctor. I go, wait a minute, that's muscular dystrophy is the thing I see Jerry Lewis at the telethon. Those are younger kids. He goes, no, that's when you learn that there's different types that affect adults. And then you learn all about it. And so, It's amazing that's where my mind went to when I was first, you know, heard the term. And it's rough to think about early on, but I do think that one of the things that after I finally got diagnosed, and you ask, well, what can be done? You know, what do you do? And there's nothing at that point. And my attitude was at that point, you know, if I had gone from being the 23-year-old getting diagnosed and the way I felt at that moment to now, if that happened in the span of a week, it would have been an incredible lifestyle change. It would have been completely debilitating. But what I go through with FSHD, it's very, you know, it's gradual, and I've gotten used to it, and it's, you know, you're losing a little bit each year, and you're adjusting. So it's hard to go through that. But at that moment, you know, I still felt more, you know, virile, you know, more, I was stronger, and it wasn't totally life-changing at that point. So what I say is, all right, well, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can take. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue to live my life the way I always envisioned living it. I'm not going to now devote all my efforts into spanning the world to try and find some cure something that's hidden or people don't know about. Like, I'm not going to go chasing windmills right now.
Right.
I am going to let science take its course. I'm going to continue to live my life, because what I don't want to have now, it's already robbing me of things that I like to do. It's already robbing me of the strength that I need to do certain things. I'm not going to let it rob me of the dreams that I had as a kid growing up, watching you on Channel 9 or other guys, listening to Marv Albert and saying, I want to be a sportscaster. You know, I worked with the great Marty Glickman in college, and you know, he inspired me to be the best professional broadcaster that I can be, and he prepared me to do it. Now here I was facing it. I was 23. I'd been an award-winning sportscaster at Fordham, and I was interning with the Giants, and I was working with the Nets, and I'm going, damn, I'm not going to let this thing now. It's already going to be a hard enough thing to deal with. I'm not going to let it strip me of everything else. And part of that dream was having a, you know, falling in love, getting married, having a family. And when you devote your mind and set out to do something like that, then you go out and you do it. And you deal with everything else and let see how that can fit into it, rather than sort of mold your dreams around whatever hardships you may be finding. No, go out and set forth and do what you wanted to accomplish, your accomplishments to be. Go out, accomplish the things you wanted to accomplish, and then and try and do it within the bounds that you find yourself in. And that's just always what I've tried to do. And I, you know, when I think of Laura and I think of Christopher, that's always been my focus.
Well, you know, when I had asked you to come on, I'm not laughing, but it's certainly nothing to laugh about. But I remember, you know, and listen, I'm used to dealing with people, and you know, a lot of them don't have happy endings. In fact, that are quite the contrary. They're sad endings. But I remember you saying to me, "Hey, Russ, it could be a lot worse. I could have ALS." And that might not register with a lot of people, but it registered with me because, yeah, I've seen the different stages of different diseases. You know, I think there's over like 40 neuromuscular diseases.
Yeah, and not to be flippant about something like that. And you know, I kind of just feel like I remember at the time when I was diagnosed and they were trying to rule out certain things. I mean, that was one of the things they brought up.
Yeah.
And that's a scary, you know, that's where you go, whoa, all right, well, at least I know my life is not in danger. And you know, certain people, you can look at things one way or the other. You know, some people are glass, a half full guy,
amen,
and some people are half empty guy.
Yep.
So I look at it and go, well, I get diagnosed this. I say, well, you know, it could be a lot worse.
Well, let me ask you this, Chris, because, you know, seeing you the last time we ran into each other, and that's what made me think about, you know, getting you on, was it during preseason at MetLife Stadium at a Giants preseason game. And, you know, it was obvious to me that obviously the disease has advanced to a point where it definitely, you know, it affects your gait and your use of your hands. My question is, how difficult is it day in, day out, night in, night out? I mean, for crying out loud, you're in Kansas City yesterday. Am I right?
Yeah.
You're in Kansas City yesterday doing a football game. You're back home in Jersey today. You know, you're walking around. You're not, you know, it's not like the average Joe who doesn't have this. FSHD.
Yeah.
How do you do that on a daily basis?
I got off a plane at 10 o'clock last night at LaGuardia, and I was at the NBA offices today at 6:30 in the morning doing a game from China off a TV screen. Well, I will say this: I used to be much more independent when it came to traveling around. I, you know, just as you noticed that things probably a little worse than the last time you and I had seen each other.
Right.
It's funny because, you know, you get to that point where you need more help to do things. And I used to think, and that was part of, I think, before I started the foundation, I think, it, you know, back when we started in 2011, people were on kind of a need-to-know basis back then. You know, certain people I was with all the time, they kind of needed to know I had certain difficulties, limitations. Sometimes I needed help, sometimes I didn't, but they kind of knew. I probably thought I hid it more than I did. You know, we all think we're George Clooney when we walk around, and then, you know, you're honest with yourself and you go, well, you know, I watch myself on tape walking or going to shake somebody's hand. You realize that, no, I do look a little like there's something, you know, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I stopped trying to hide it and think that I didn't want people to know, that's when I came out and I started the foundation. And it also relieved this burden because I always say when you try and hide something like this, you have two burdens. You have the burden of the disease and then you have the burden of trying to hide it.
Yeah.
And once you're not worried about hiding it, you always worry about how it affects your relationships and how people view you. But what are you going to do? It is what it is. It's there. So you might as well turn it into a positive. And when I want to keep doing what I'm doing, I need help. So, you know, when I'm on the road with the Nets, I have Tim Capstraw with me, my partner. And he, you know, will physically lift me out of a chair. And I have other people that we travel with, and when we've got to go up and down the plane steps or get on the buses, that they are there to boost me up, hold my bags, grab me, boost me up, let me hold on to them as I'm walking across the tarmac if there's some wind blowing or there's some ice on the ground. And they all look out for me, and they all try and help. And they need more help as we get further along. The company I do football for, Compass Media Networks, have an owner in Peter Kosan who was one of the first people to call me when I started the foundation and said, what can I do for you? And, you know, he's been there financially and supporting the foundation. He comes to our dinner. He brings the whole company. But also a couple of years ago, he said to me, hey, I know, you know, when you're traveling for us, the crew has come from all over. You're traveling commercially by yourself. Would it help if someone was with you?
Hmm.
And I said, yes, it really would help. So he said, great, why don't you have somebody that can help you travel with you, and I'll pay their expenses to travel. And I got my neighbor, Ira, across the street. He's a big sports fan. He just has the empty nest with the final kid going to college. So he's got his weekends free, and he loves football. And I taught him how to be my spotter.
Right.
And he comes on the road with me.
Excellent.
And he's a big guy. He can lift me, you know, when I'm in a little plane seat. And when he goes and gets the rental car when we get there, so I don't have to get on the shuttle and go get the rental car. And he helps me out of all these spots. And he loves it because he's hanging out before the game on the field at Arrowhead yesterday,
yeah,
you know, for the biggest game of the week. And it's a, you know, mutually beneficial thing. And so that's the kind of thing where, you have to raise your hand and ask for help if you want to keep doing what you're going to do. You know, and eventually I may need more things that are more visual to people that I, in my own mind, feel shocking. Like if I've experimented with using a scooter sometimes to get around, if I'm I have to walk along a lot, or, you know, I'm on vacation somewhere, or it just, these things aren't done to belittle you. They're done to help you be more independent. And, you know, because I always, in my mind, am worried, well, all these people that know me, I know, you know, I have so many contacts, so many people that know me. You know, I've been in this business. You know, when you're in art, the business that we're in, you just make so many contacts and people that know you. And now suddenly, you know, what if I need a scooter and they're going to see me in it? How's that going to look? Well, I don't think it's really, that's more of the hurdle that I have to get past. That person, I don't think, is going to care. In fact, they're going to want to know how they can do more to help. But, you know, it is frustrating because sometimes I catch myself where I'm in the middle of a game and it's a good one and I'm having a great broadcast and I go, man, I can do this job really well. I could do it, in fact, as well as anybody in the country. but it is hard getting to that booth. And I know that other guys don't have to worry about that. You know, they don't have the, all the guys that I'm competing with in this business, and we know how highly competitive this business is. They, all they're concerned about is catching their flight, doing their homework, prep. They don't have to worry about, you know, how long it takes for them to get dressed, or how they're gonna, now they need somebody to travel with them so they can get out of the, you know, get up from the plane seat. You know, like, those are the things that I have to weigh on my mind and that take time in order for me to exceed and excel in this business. But you know what? I'm not complaining about that.
Sure.
I'm not saying, hey, life ain't fair. I'm saying, no, it is what it is, but I've got to go now and try and get the help that I need so that I can get to my seat, so I can get to my post, and I can do the job that I'm paid to do as well as I can do it. And, you know, I sometimes I say, hey, it makes the accomplishments even more rewarding.
Well,
because
you,
I know what I had to go through to get there.
Your accomplishments, listen, I'm not, as only Russ could say in his Brooklyn lingo, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but for crying out loud, your accomplishments and forget your accomplishments as a broadcaster, which are certainly tremendous, but your accomplishment of people listening to this, inspiring people, and they're not just listening to this. You have the Chris Carino Foundation.org, and is that, if people want to donate, or is that the place to get in touch with, the Chris Carino Foundation.org, or is there a phone number?
That's the website. You know, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
You can find us. And, you know, I try and tell my story as many people as I can. I went from, you know, 2010, not, you know, trying to hide it, to in 2011, I start the foundation, and suddenly I'm telling my story to the world. And I think the thing is, I'm trying to reach as many people who might hear it and just be inspired, whether they have FSHD or muscular dystrophy or something else. Everybody's got something that they're trying to overcome in their life. You know, I hope I can help those people in some way. And at the same time, there's a practical side of it. And like I said, I wanted to let science take its course. And I think sometimes you have to help with that. You know, miracles, scientific breakthroughs are miracles, but you have to work to make those miracles. You have to put yourself in a position to succeed. And I saw where the science of the disease was, that they figured out what caused the disease, this overexpression of a gene called DUX4.
Mm-hmm.
And now all these scientists are targeting DUX4 and how we can control it. And we've donated somewhere in the vicinity of $700,000 in grants.
God bless.
And those are all, you know, seed research grants at universities that have led to millions of dollars in NIH grants, National Institute of Health. You know, small breakthroughs with that was the thing. I used to be intimidated because I'd see all the money that Jerry Lewis would raise in muscular dystrophy and say, well, you know, I'm going to need to raise millions of dollars. But no, you can give a $50,000 grant to a university that's studying something, and they make breakthroughs that lead to $1 million in research grants from bigger institutions.
Hey, Chris, let me tell you something. And you brought up something that's very important for not just your foundation, but for anything. And if you recall, when I used to do the telethons, I used to tell people, I used to say, you know, send in the shkarol, whatever you got. But I'd make sure to say nothing is too small. I mean, I don't, you know, a buck to somebody might be $1,000 to somebody else, or vice. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Nobody should ever feel, you know, what they donate, or like you say, that, to me, it's not a contest. As you said so well before, it's a challenge. And the challenge is, you know, when I do my thing each year, and believe me, Chris, when is your dinner?
In July every year.
Okay, you know what? Where is the dinner? Is it in New York?
Russo's on the Bay, your kind of place, out in Howard Beach.
You know something? I love to be there next year.
You're going to be there.
So you let me know. But you know, to me, it's just, it's people need to know that there's nothing too big and there's nothing too small.
I got a donation one time. We ran this bike tour that went across the country last year, and guys were trying to raise money for us, and it was a great physical challenge for these guys, and they did a great job, and they met people along the way, and there was a family they met out in Salt Lake City that has FSHD, and you know, the one boy he sent a $20 bill and just said it was from the money he made pulling weeds in the garden for his parents, and I said, to me that meant more to me than any, not to belittle any big donation I've gotten, but that meant as much to me as anything, you know, the sacrifice and the intent behind it, and just people wanting to help people. And the more I do this kind of stuff and talk to people, like I said, you want to be inspiring to people, but then you also, you know, you meet people that may help and financially can help and help us fund more research. And that's, it just takes one, you know, just take the right person.
But the most important thing you're saying, Chris, your story needs to be out, and not everybody knows it because it's an inspiring story. And by keeping it quiet, people don't know about it. And that's the sad thing about, listen, everybody's entitled to their privacy. And I always listen, if you told me, hey, Russ, I don't want to do this, I get you. You know, I'm not going through it. You're the guy who's going through it. You know, and you don't know.
It's hard, and it's hard on, and you know, we've talked about this. You mentioned before about, you know, my family and Laura and Chris. I mean, you know, they're kind of, you know, I know Laura's a very private person, and you know, she's had to adjust to me sharing all this, but was my inspiration to share it because she said, you can't, you know, bury your head in the sand anymore with this. You have to. You know, you don't know. You may be able to inspire people. You may be able to lead to a cure for this disease. So as private as we like to be in our personal life with this aspect of it, you know, we feel like it's important to get it out there. And it's hard. They have to, you know, they have to adjust to seeing me in certain conditions and sharing my story. And it's an adjustment for me. I mean, I would love to just be anonymous. But, you know, that's always the way even my style of broadcasting has never been to call attention to myself. It's about the game.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way I've always approached it. But, you know, knowing that for the sake of trying to get a cure for this disease, I got to get over myself and, you know, get out there and try and, you know, ruffle the feathers and beat the bushes a little bit.
Yes, yes, indeed. You know, Chris, obviously, you know, there's a chance your future rests in a wheelchair. Does that prey on your mind, or you just, like you say, get up every morning, put on your pants, and go to work?
What has always scared me, that was always the thing that probably scared me the most. And then, as anything, when you finally are faced with that thing you fear, it's usually not as bad as you envisioned it to be, because fear is sort of this thing in the future. It's not real. And you know, danger is real. Fear is not. It's what you conjure up in your brain. And already the little things that I have to do that I never thought I'd be in a position that I needed the help to do, you go, all right, well, this, I was so scared of this happening, but now it's here and this is how I deal with it. If I want to do what I want to do. And I'm willing now to see what I'll do, whatever I have to do to keep living my life the way I want to live it. And the other part of it is I get to a point where maybe sometimes it stops me from doing things. But if I was in a situation where I wasn't worried about falling or something like that, then I might do more with my life. And, you know, whether it be a scooter or a wheelchair, I don't know. I'm still hoping that, hey, you know, while I'm still getting around like I am now, you know, I know that there's a clinical trial coming up next year with a drug. There are more coming down the road. I may worry about the end game, but meanwhile, in 2 years, there could be a pill that I take every day that's going to halt the progression. You don't know. So, I'm going to use something to get around some point.
Mm-hmm.
I worry, though, sometimes about how it affects the other people in my life. You know, the burden that it puts on people that now have to help me with that. And that's always been sort of my, you know, I've always liked my independence, and when you don't have that, that's as hard. That's probably the biggest fear. But what's the alternative? You know, to sit in your house and not do anything. Mm. That's the alternative, and that's, to me, that's not an alternative. That's not going to happen.
Well,
so, and like I one time, Russ, just to finish up, I mean, when it was getting a little more difficult about a year and a half ago, I sat down with Tim Capstraw, and I said, you know, I don't know. I'm having a hard time now with this, and I don't know how long can I keep doing this. And he said, well, you're not going to quit. You're not going to stop. He goes, well, we'll figure out a way. And that's the thing. You know, we just, you figure out a way.
Well, Chris, I got to tell you, there's one thing about people who deal with the challenge, as you say, of muscular dystrophy and some 40 neuromuscular diseases, and yours is FSHD. They amaze me all the time because they continue to inspire. And this has been the most inspiring podcast that I've had since I'm doing it for the past 6 months. It's just, you're an inspiration to a lot of people, my friend. And, I hope you continue to inspire, and I'll never listen to a Nets game on the radio the same way, because it always is going to mean a lot more to me. And I think when people listen to this podcast, it will always mean a lot more to them. It is the ChrisCarinoFoundation.org, folks. Go on a website, check it out. If you want to reach into your pockets and send Chris and a foundation a little shkadol, nothing's too big, nothing's too small.
And everything we raise, Russ, I don't have anyone, I'm not, there's no payroll, there's no rent. Whatever we take in, we give to research. So,
Chris, again, you're an inspiration. You're terrific at what you do, and the way you inspire just makes Mr. Chris Carino that much more special.
Chris.
So continue good health, and we'll be listening to you come Wednesday night, next Wednesday, when the season opens in Detroit. And, again, all good things, my friend.
Thank you so much, Russ.
All right, thank you. That is Chris Carino. And now, folks, man, boy, that is one inspiring man. And that's a wrap on today. I want to thank you all for getting a load of this. Now I'd like to get a load of you. You can let me know your thoughts on today's conversation with the terrific Chris Carino. You can let me know on Twitter at Russ Salzberg, on Facebook. You can also check out my website at russsalzberg.com. Easy enough. My thanks to 77 WABC Program Director Craig Schwab, to Assistant Program Director Matt Dahl, my buddy here, running the board across the way, Crash, also known as Mike Caragliano, OG Podcast Network, and the OG Podcast Network producer, Tim Einenkel, who puts this together. And as always, got to thank yous, the fans out there, because without yous, guys, I'd have nobody to talk to. So until next time, I'm Russ Salzberg, saying to all of you, bye-bye, so long, and farewell.